Hi, everyone. Before we start the show, we have a couple of quick announcements. The first is that we'll be doing a live recording of the podcast at Super Week in Hungary at the end of January. We would love to meet you there, so head on over to superweek.hu and give that a look. Next, we've got a couple of big announcements. As we kick off our third year of the podcast, we've got some exciting updates. We now have a website. You can find us at analyticshour.io. Tim informs me that the .io means that we're cool. And on that site, we now have an official way for you to submit a topic you would like to have us cover on the show. Second, starting with episode 51, the one with Mo Kiss, we're now posting transcriptions of each episode on our site. We don't think you want to read the show, but maybe it will help if there's something you heard that you want to go back and find. Anyways, we're excited about what 2017 will bring. Check out superweek.hu, analyticshour.io, and now on with the show.
Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 54. Sometimes the best way to look within is to get a perspective from the outside. So get ready for what might be a sharp dose of the proverbial analytics smelling salts, or at least we hope so. You know, as thought leaders, Tim Wilson and I, Michael Helbling, are frequently asked our opinions on best practices, what's happening in the industry, and other digital analytics miscellany. And Tim's advice is even highly valued. But who is watching the watchers? In this case, the watchers being thought leaders in our fine digital analytics community. Sometimes it's a bit too easy to tweet that self-serving industry link, not knowing that it's eroding the trust and not building the skills of the real heroes of our industry, the fine men and women in jobs that aren't allowed to speak publicly about what they're doing, but are doing some of the best work in analytics. Well, to diagnose our industry's problems with his aptly named Pop Analytics, we have a guest. His Twitter is legendary for making social media quote-unquote experts confused and provoking deep thought in the rest of us. That's right, our guest is Kevin Hillstrom. Kevin is president of Mind That Data, a consultancy that helps CEOs understand the complex relationships between customers, advertising, products, brands, and channels. Prior to founding Mind That Data, Kevin held various roles at leading multi-channel brands, including Vice President of Database Marketing at Nordstrom's, Director of Circulation at Eddie Bauer, and Manager of Analytics Services at Land's End. You can also find his blog posts on his blog at blog.mindthatdata.com, and he is a member of our podcast community. You can find his podcast at soundcloud.com/mindthatdata. Kevin, it is a delight and an honor to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with a little question. Where did this term Pop Analytics first come up for you, and what was sort of the genesis of that?
I mean, honestly, the genesis had a lot to do with what I would call, in the last month or so, we've read a lot about fake news. And you'll read how people were being misled by certain information, either, you know, politically or however you want to define it. There was just a lot of talk about how you could basically publish your own ideas. The ideas didn't have to be truthful. And then people would embrace those ideas and run with them. And as I was comparing the concept of politics and what we were seeing there with analytics, I just started to see some parallels. And more importantly, I saw parallels where I had a person on Twitter from the UK who told me that I was focusing on dogma. And I had to stop and think about what was I reciting or saying things that were basically true, or was I saying things that just kind of fit the narrative that I wanted to talk about? And I started to think maybe I'm a little bit biased in that there are certain, you know, ways that I want to think of the world. And maybe when I evaluate how other people view the world, they also have biases. So I kind of came up with the term pop analytics because it's sort of a parallel between, you know, classical music, let's say, and pop music, right? So in pop music, there's a structure in place that if you want to get a song on Spotify or you want it to be popular, you want your song on the radio, there is a process you go through to make that happen. And similarly, in analytics, you can do really great work. You could be like a classical musician, but your work isn't necessarily going to get noticed by an ecosystem that basically rewards people who do what the ecosystem wants the ecosystem to do. And so that's where I started to come up with the idea of pop analytics, that there's a popular form of analytics that tends to get most of the attention and may or may not necessarily be the best thing for individual analysts at individual companies to employ. And that's kind of how I got there.
What's kind of your top three kind of examples of pop analytics? Like deep learning, is that that fall? People who are touting deep learning for optimizing their advertising spend, is that a pop analytics example?
It sure can be. So deep learning in and of itself is fine. I don't have an issue with that. And I would have clients that are doing spectacular work there. So that's not my concern. I would say that any time that, I'll give you an example. When I worked at Nordstrom, I received an email from a vendor, and the vendor was recommending a customer relationship management process that involved email marketing and wanted to basically personalize how email campaigns were constructed so that response would increase in the email campaigns. And so I got the email from the vendor at about 10 in the morning, and at noon, one of my managers came into my office. And the manager sat down and said, I want to have a serious discussion about email marketing. I've got a great idea. And the great idea is personalization. And here is how I want to address it. And within 5 minutes, I could tell that this person had read the email and the person didn't have his own idea. This person was doing something because a vendor thought it was a good idea. And the vendor convinced my employee that I should hear this message. And so anything that has to do with, be it A/B testing, personalization, optimization, anything that requires you to engage your audience, anything that requires you to go deep into an AI rabbit hole, if you will, those kinds of things that where somebody is requiring you to do something because it's ultimately going to benefit them more than you, that's what I call pop analytics.
So they're kind of I think vendors are definitely largely to blame for that. As you were talking about that example, is there a piece of that that's also kind of the crawl run? Like, we're struggling to get enough content together for our monthly email newsletter that goes to our entire database. And somebody comes in and says, we should be doing personalized email. And you're like, well, that's great, but that means you're going to have to drastically increase your content production because you're going to now, well, you know, so it's trying to like skip a step. We want to do multi-channel attribution and we don't even have like last click attribution nailed down. We can't get tagging. And maybe that's more of is that a symptom of pop analytics? Somebody's chasing a shiny object and they're just kind of, frankly, I think sometimes it's hard and non-sexy to do the stuff that's the walk step and the crawl, walk, run. And run is what everybody's out in the trade journals and talking about at conferences because it's sexy and interesting and sells. But recognizing that, hey, we're not ready for that. That's great to have that as a vision, but we have to recognize what our path is to get there. Is that fair?
I think that's completely fair. And to me, it's a reflection of business knowledge on behalf of the analyst. So I think when you have a really good analyst understands what the business needs and what the business is capable of doing. And so the analyst is only going to implement ideas or solutions that are basically where the analyst knows that he or she can push the business in the right direction. And the idea is going to be embraced. And so the analyst has basically become an ambassador for what's best for the business the analyst works for. And what I tend to see instead are outside forces who are pushing analysts towards solutions that, to your point, are maybe four steps further than where the analyst knows that the organization can go. So I have a client that I met with about 3 weeks ago, and their mobile analytics are not good. And in fact, some of their basic, you know, what you would call CRM type stuff from 20 years ago is horrible. And so when I'm trying to outline a project for them, I'm not going to push them down the mobile path because they need to go down 21 steps before they even get there. Yet when I'm in the meeting, the vice president of analytics is talking about things that are 15 steps down the path. And the vice president was talking about specific vendors and specific solutions from specific vendors.
Who he'd happened to have gone to, been taken to lunch with at the conference 2 weeks earlier, or taken, he got a nice dinner from that vendor, just so happens. I mean, not necessarily because they bought them dinner, but it's a shiny object, right? The vendors have a nice story, and it's like the Scott Brinker marketing technology landscape. There are just so many out there, and you can pick any one of them, and they have a good story. And if you're not appropriately attuned to your own situation and the realities of the reality and the fact that some of these companies have been around for 6 months. Do you have a take on the Chief Martech marketing technology landscape? You don't have to.
I've been lucky enough to work for other vendors in my career, and I've been on the other side of the table where I have to hit a sales number during the course of a period of time, and it's going to require me to behave differently than I would like to behave. And so I understand how the marketing technology folks are going to push a certain agenda. And to be really fair to analysts, you know, you brought up the dinner concept, that someone took somebody out to dinner. A lot of analysts are isolated at companies, and they don't have a lot of people who love them or understand them. And so when you do have somebody from the outside who's willing to take you to dinner and treat you well and kind of see the world the way you see it, that does have an influence. And I continually see that across my client base. I am constantly made aware of a vendor taking somebody out to dinner and then at the dinner promoting certain ideas, and those ideas then get spread across the organization. There is a love that vendors can give some of my analysts that I work with that they don't get with their coworkers. And that love that they get from a vendor then influences how the analyst is going to interact with the rest of the business.
You're not wrong, Kevin, and actually vendors do that not just with dinners, but, you know, hey, put your card in the fishbowl, maybe you'll win, and oh wow, you won, congratulations, and let's get a conversation about our product and you and how can you help us, and all these things happen are just part of that process. It's difficult. I don't think anybody out there is trying to be evil.
Correct.
But like you said, there's a motivation on the other side that is, hey, I've got numbers to hit. You know, I do the same thing. I take analysts out to dinner and stuff, but I'm actually trying to hire them. So that's my secret. I just, you're like, no one's showing you any love. And I'll come work with Search. No, I'm just kidding. So
searchdiscovery.com/
That's right.
Careers.
Yeah, I don't
jobs.
Know.
I don't know. I still don't know what the URL is.
We'll have a new one by the time this show launches, probably. So yeah, and on the other side of that, it's easy to get excited about a cool technology. You know, thinking about my time as an analyst, you see something, it's like, wow, that solution could do so many things for us. And you aren't necessarily ready to think about every piece of that, right? Ownership, right. Maintenance, all the what data needs to go into it. How does it, and there's so much more to any kind of platform or, you know, whiz bang thing that of course is never discussed in the sales cycle because those are just details. And that's where we all get hung up. Right. And actually, you know, from a prior podcast where we had Matt Gershoff on talking about personalization has an upper bound, right? There's sort of this Faustian bargain of, well, how much personalization can you afford to do? Because it's sort of like, well, every vendor is telling you, well, just have a one-to-one conversation with every customer. It's like, well, I've got 25 million customers. I don't know how to scale that.
Right.
So, yeah. No, it's good.
If you look at a career path for an analyst, if I go back to my days when I was at a Lands' End or an Eddie Bauer, and I want my career to progress on a certain path, it's going to be very hard for me to hit my career goals within the company I'm working with. It's going to be a lot easier to achieve my goals if I get the skills that the vendor is recommending I obtain, and then those skills can translate to another organization. There's a clear incentive for me to learn what different, you know, technology providers are offering or what solutions providers are offering, because that makes me more attractive to other companies. And so a lot of the analysts I work with then have this incentive that it doesn't necessarily align with the company that's paying them. And so that's just a challenge that, you know, when I talk about pop analytics, that's all part of that process. The analyst is being pulled into a world that isn't necessarily aligned with their organization, and it's neither good nor bad. It just is.
So if I recognize that technology X, which just looks like to be like they're phenomenal at marketing themselves, they do guerrilla marketing like crazy, they show up and crash other technologies events, whatever, I think they're going to have a large footprint, and it may be a little poppy, and lots of companies are going to buy it. And if I can get my company to buy it and I can learn it well enough, then I actually, there's a good chance that a lot of companies will be struggling to use it. And now they are going to, they potentially are going to say, we need to get somebody who knows this technology. That's terrible. That's like, maybe that's how IBM, half of their platforms have actually managed to work their ways throughout into the entire universe. But I think the other thing about chasing, I mean, specifically around the technology aspect of pop analytics is, to me, it's this, and again, it's not an intentional or evil thing that somebody inside a company is doing, but if I hear the story of this technology is going to solve, make my life better, then as soon as I convince somebody to get that technology, immediately I have bought myself time. I have bought myself 3 months, 6 months, or a year, because we have to actually get through procurement, acquire the technology, go through the discovery, gather the requirements, get it implemented. And so we've automatically kind of said, oh, you know what? We have the solution. It's not, the cavalry's on the way, but it's not going to be here for 6 months, which kind of immediately gives us some breathing room. And I don't think it's that conscious of a process. I think we've probably all been down the path of, by the time 6 months or 9 months or a year hits, expectations are insanely high, because now that new technology is going to solve, you know, it's going to solve why, you know, the M&Ms in the snack room are always running out on Tuesdays and don't get restocked till Thursdays. It's going to solve every possible problem. I've never worked anywhere that's stocked free M&Ms. I wish I would. If there's anyone out there who has that,
Tim, deal. Let me tell you about this exciting company, Search Discovery.
So what, like, besides technology-oriented pop in? I mean, I think that's like that's the easy one to point at, and I could rail on that all night long. What are some kind of non-buy new technology oriented examples? I mean, as long as it's not, you know, thinking you should use open source software like R to try to pursue data science. Other than that, any other example?
Oh, so that's the bridge that's too far, is that one?
Hey. No, we can go after that one too. I question that myself.
Before I answer that, tell me why you've questioned it, or tell me your thought process around evangelizing that as an idea.
So my thought process has been, I will take a simple example that since I can probably go back 10 years, it has bothered me that watching a report come out that everybody wants and there's value in it because it shows the volume of traffic to the site, or it's the volume of revenue. And watching that, we look at the report, and we say this week is gone up or down from last week. And lots of people want to go and chase up or down as being good or bad, like literally up or down. It doesn't matter how much. And I have done some probably inexcusable things to try to add to that sort of recurring reporting some indication of whether it went up or down enough for us to think that it might not just be random noise. And I've done some of that stuff in Excel, but I realized, you know, I don't really have the right answer for statistically how to say this moved enough that I should care. That's like one. Like, I'll take that one example and say multiply that by 1,000. I feel myself looking in ad hoc analysis in Adobe or Google Analytics interface, and it's just aggregated line charts. And I just deeply, deeply believe that there is more to that. And it's more to that in two ways. One, anytime I have to go and build 27 segments, export the data one thing at a time, I think, wow, if I could script this and do it faster. So there's no statistics in that. That's just get the data more efficiently and not say, no, I can't get that for you because it's unreasonable for me to get it. And then the second part, I think actually not just doing a scatter plot and putting an R-squared on it and saying, yeah, it looks like those are related. Now, if I could do that 1,000 more ways, I might find something interesting. And actually having the skills to be a little more knowledgeable about, you know, what are the variables. I mean, I'm learning terms like factorization. I've got 85 EVARs populated. I can't look at every single combination. Which one of these can I do some factor analysis? I don't know how to do that yet. So that's kind of in, that's actually the short explanation broadly of why I am pursuing, and not, it's not necessarily R. It could be R, Python, or any one of those tools. So have I defended myself or have I lost all credibility?
You have defended yourself. So you gave exactly the answer I'm looking for, okay? Because the answer you gave is not a pop analytics answer. Your answer is you want to do something that is helpful to somebody else and you're trying to find the best way possible to come up with a good outcome. And that outcome then is pushing you towards a package or a solution so that you can be more effective. So that's exactly what I want to see from an analyst. And so that makes me happy, okay? Let me give you another example. So I'm on the phone with a client a couple weeks ago and I'm explaining how I would address dealing with an issue. And the CEO is sitting with his analyst on the call. And I can hear whispering going on, okay? And the CEO says, Kevin, I would hire you. He goes, but you've got to understand, we have an analyst here who knows R and knows Python. And so therefore, the $20,000 we would pay you would be useless. We don't need your help. And so I said, okay, that's fine. I can deal with that. A week goes by. The CEO sends me an email. The CEO says, we're having problems getting the answer we want with R and Python. Can we talk about how you would help us? That is, to me, what pop analytics is about. Because pop analytics is saying there is software, and the software will provide the solution, and it de-emphasizes knowledge and curiosity among analysts and business leaders. And so I rail against anybody who says that, you know, some sort of software is the answer. You will see, you know, I get so frustrated because I will constantly see how organizations say you need to push, you know, you need to come up with a data-driven solution and push your analytics down into an organization and make it easy for everybody to do analytics. And you'll read that Tableau could be the solution for you or something else. And all of those things to me fit into the pop analytics family of things that I don't like and don't appreciate. Because to me, it devalues what you just talked about, Tim, and the essay that you just gave us about how you were having a problem and you're looking to find a solution to that problem. And so I am on your side. I want analysts to be doing what you're doing and what you just described, where you have curiosity for something, you care about it, and you're looking for a solution, and you are not married to what the right solution is. You're just married to coming up with a way to do a better job for the people who are hiring you. So I'm very glad you gave that answer, because that's what I'm trying to encourage.
Whew. Big sigh of relief.
And you're okay in my book too, Tim. Good job. No.
Well, that I don't give a shit about. So
I would even say, Kevin, that even if you look at it from the other side, we're all consultants, right? We do work with clients. Customers come to us saying, hey, help me do this tool. And so if I want to grow my business, right, I need to be able to say, hey, I'm an expert with this tool. And then you'll find a lot of consulting out there to help do tools. And it's perverse, because you can do a lot of bad with great tools because you're just doing the tool. And at the same time, customers don't know how to ask you for what it is that they actually need sometimes. And so you have to have, like, our whole consultancy is built on this model of, how do we help you start to derive value out of this set of tools? Even though probably you engage us in the first place a lot of times to help you do a very specific scope of putting a tool in place. Help me put this tool on my website. Okay, that's fine. But now how are we gonna pull this into what you're doing each day? How does this metric mean anything to your business? And how would you use that to determine if something is more or less likely to happen as a result of that? Ideally, with an idea going forward from there into kind of a deeper understanding of actual people who come to your websites. So it's tricky, because it's sort of like you're always walking this tightrope. And, you know, I'm now the guy on the outside, you know, I've kind of have the chance to be on both sides. I think actually all of us have kind of been both practitioners and consultants over our careers, but it's difficult because I think it's helpful though to be able to say, hey, you don't need this product from us. You don't need this tool. What you actually need to do is go hire a really good analyst right now. You need to go hire an analyst and then come talk to me in 6 months when they've had a chance to ramp up. And you know, I don't tell people to do that very often, but I'm proud of those moments where you do say to the people, the best thing you could do is not spend money on me. The best thing you could do is go spend money on...
With Demystified.
Well, yeah. No, of course. Plug.
Well, how often... I feel like, Michael, you and I are definitely, because we've got this kind of web analytics tie, like, I mean, Google and Adobe, and absolutely, we need somebody to help come in and help us do stuff with these tools. Kevin, do you get my perception? And of course, the grass is always greener on the other side. Is that people come to you and say, I have my database. I feel like I'm throwing money away with a lot of my catalogs I'm sending, or on, are they asking you the right kind of questions, or do you get clients who are kind of asking you a question where they've presupposed an answer that may be pop analytics type answer? And I guess, do you try to steer them to say, are you going to be receptive to a non-pop analytics solution? And if you're not, then I'm not the person for you. Like, how does that work with clients who are coming to you based on kind of like your reputation in the space?
I have branded myself on purpose to not answer the questions that a pop analytics person would answer. So what I'm typically answering are a CEO or a chief marketing officer or a chief merchandising officer or a chief financial officer are asking me, why is my business failing? That's literally the question I get, is why is my business failing? And that allows me a playground that is enormous. So my scope is not narrow then. I've purposely branded myself so that I get to have a large scope. And now because I have a large scope, the answer might be it's a digital issue. It might be that it's an offline issue. There might be tools that can help my client perform better. I get to have a large playground with that. And so I think, and what I end up running into is there is usually an analyst or a team of analysts at the company that's hiring me. And those people are either not being listened to, or those people are just fundamentally wrong. And that's where for me, things get interesting because it's almost never about the tools that they have in-house, and it's never about how to use the tools. It's either management doesn't want to hear a word that the analysts are saying, or the analysts are just completely going down the wrong path and management knows it. And so I end up spending an awful lot of time on my projects then as being just like a people person, trying to get people to talk and trying to tell a story with the information that is going to cause people to talk. And so I get to craft really interesting outcomes then. I don't have to have a specific outcome that is tied to a tool and tied to a methodology. I get to have a pretty broad range of things that I can do. And the way I look at the business then gets to be a lot more interesting. But I had to do that on purpose and build my business that way over 10 years so that I could have that kind of fun, so that I didn't get married into having to answer small questions that would not benefit the business.
Got it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just talking consulting shop for a second, you do have to really specifically guide your consultancy where you want it to go. Because, yes, you know, SDI's story was, hey, we have a tag management tool that we sold to Adobe. And so you guys are the Adobe DTM guys. Our first year post that sale, we were the DTM guys. And it's like, okay, I didn't start a career in analytics so I could do tags for a living. So that's where we're going to start with people. But then what are we going to, and you have to really have an idea of, okay, well, that's not how I want it. And to a certain extent, Tim, I think Demystify is the same way. There's a philosophy behind the business that is guiding how things are set up and how you're doing things.
I appreciate your generous.
Well, I just want to pull everybody into it. Everybody's trying to be you. Don't just take it. Just take the compliment.
So tell anyway. Me, Tim, with your business then, do you feel like that you have a vision for where you want to take things and where you ultimately want to go, and that you are bridging that between the work you're currently doing and where you want things to be in a couple of years? Do you have a process in place that helps you get where you want to go?
Oh my God, you are one perceptive son of a bitch. I mean, there's part of me that is, Tim can build you a nice dashboard. Like, we'll get your web analytics data good, and your web analytics data does need to be good. And you know what? You don't want to spend a bunch of time every week pulling a recurring report, or if somebody wants to look at something they want to explore, but they don't want to learn the interface. So I've kind of managed to inadvertently get myself kind of marched down the path of, you know, you can automate stuff in Excel that's using web analytics data or data that's in the web analytics platform. And And there's value there, right? I mean, I have a process. We go through, we talk through what's the right stuff for you to look at, for you to monitor your business and identify where there might be issues. But that tends to still wind up as the, you know, you can build a pretty dashboard in Excel. So to me, there is a deeper, I look at management consultants, which are easy, or, you know, take the Deloittes of the world, take the EYs. Yes. That are coming in and are tend to be brought in from somebody at a higher level asking a bigger question. And I think in a way, like Gary Angel, this was kind of part of the, when he has sort of talked about this as well. You're not starting with my conversion rate's not good. The data's not good for this thing. And that's where you're starting. It can be difficult to work your way up to say, we want to kind of tweak and tune these little small things. So I feel like that for the web analytics or the digital analytics world, there's a risk that entire profession could get their clocks cleaned by individuals and organizations that are coming in and starting out asking bigger questions at a higher level that matter more, that aren't wedded to this narrow world of digital and the website and the Facebook page. And I think that's where it's going. So maybe there's a little bit of fear. I'm just old enough that I could probably ride it out on doing clever stuff in Excel and doing kind of ad hoc analysis here and there and make sure we have a good hypothesis and make sure that there's action being driven. And clients will be perfectly happy because they would look and say, this is how much money we gave him. And these are the questions he answered. And these were the incremental value or insights that he provided. I don't think 10 years, 15, 20 years from now, that's going to carry much weight. I think all this other data that's happening data that's out there, one, it doesn't change the fundamentals of, do we really know our business? Have we thought about our business? Do we know how the parts move and they interconnect? And it challenges me when clients don't want to kind of think about that. But then the separate part is saying we can't really think about just one channel. And maybe I will start to sound thought leaderish. Oh, it's all about omni-channel. Yeah, omni-channel. I'm trying to see if you have it. That makes you fall out of your chair. You know, but so that's, I probably don't have as clear of a vision as I should, but I definitely have a vision that what I'm doing right now is pretty siloed and narrow, and I'm trying to figure out my way around that.
See,
me later. What's your bill rate for this therapy session?
Well, my homework assignment for you, and it's not something you're going to answer today, but I think this goes for most analysts, is that you go down a path where you align with a technology and you get to be really good at marrying business issues to that technology and coming up with solutions. And then you just brought up something that was interesting. You talked about Deloitte or some big management consultant who will come into a company and for $750,000, they're going to provide a 70,000 foot solution that they're going to be running from in 4 months, and a bunch of foot soldiers are going to have to implement and have no passion for it. And so both of those things to me get a lot of attention from a pop analytics standpoint. And what I hear you saying is there's a hole, if you will. And there's a hole where an analyst can go. So to me, a really good analyst goes and finds a hole that is not getting as much attention as it should. And that hole oftentimes is, there is a business issue that business people are missing that analytics or software or technology is missing, but because you have enough experience now, you know that hole has an opportunity, and you have experience that tells you that there's going to be a 70% chance you're going to have success if you go and fill that hole. And to me, that is a transition that a generation of what I would call digital analysts are going to go through over the next 10 years. So in other words, this is just my opinion. Digital analysts have spent the last 10 years wiring basically how the internet works and how commerce works and how customer engagement works and how customers interact with each other. They've spent 10 years wiring that. And now Pop Analytics wants analysts to go deeper into that. And to me, analysts have an opportunity to do the opposite. And analysts have an opportunity then to step into the business a little bit more. And there's just a ton. And Michael, maybe you could talk a little bit about what you experienced at Land's End, because you would have a shared experience with me there. There is a hole that is as big as you can possibly imagine between ordinary garden variety analytics and what the business actually needs to be successful. And so yeah. I'll let you, Michael, talk about that. But I think that's a gigantic hole that a digital analyst can move into in the next several years.
No, you're absolutely right. It was because of that experience that I sort of shifted how I describe myself as an analyst, because really what I determined what was needed of me to help was to just be a business person who is using data in meaningful ways. Don't be a digital analyst. Don't be, you know, don't put yourself in such a small box. You need to be able to go up to where the business is working. And it was what that was sort of where I learned, hey, all these digital metrics that I've been working with, they have no English equivalent in how people run businesses. And the best insights we generated were typically and that were adopted. So in other words, we generated some insight from our data, but we got them adopted by the business and we drove value to the business. They were all presented in terms of how the business talked about itself, not in terms of my set of metrics. Mm-hmm. And so that was the big illuminator that sort of said, okay, so what I really need to do is I need to transcend my data set or at least understand the translation between the two so that I can help the business understand what it is that I'm seeing in the web data. Because nobody at the C-level is going to come down and see my metrics, you know, and understand that, wow, bounce rate is really important. And unless they, you know, they went to a conference and suddenly heard somebody say bounce rate's really important. And then they're like, you know what? Bounce rate needs to go on our big time review dashboard. And it's like, but why? What does it do? And you were so, well, it's bounce rate. You just have to get it lower. Well, you know that half our traffic doesn't even come in on the homepage, right? They come in via direct, you know, it's so it's this yes. whole other thing. But again, how does it connect? What's the connection? Bounce rate's not a thing to a business. That's not EBITDA. That's not revenue. That's not orders. That's bounce rate. It means nothing unless it's relatable to the things that actually drive the business. So that was probably the biggest thing as an analyst I learned from being at Land's End was that everything we did over there in digital analytics had to come back into the business in business terms. And then we could actually start to have a conversation and move some stuff around. But then the other piece was you had to then step into the role of the guy moving stuff around because you had to do that part too. So you certainly, you stop being the analyst and you start being the project manager of the new change you want to see.
And so to me, that's an important point that you bring up because in a pop analytics world, you'd be told that you have to become a storyteller and you have to tell compelling stories to get people to act. And what you just described was, I just told a story and it's going to require me to act. I'm going to become the project manager. And that's an analyst goes through a process where eventually they figure out that it's going to be hard to get other people to act the way you want them to. And you as an analyst start to basically move much closer to the business as a result. And that is a transition that I see happening among the analysts I'm working with is they're beginning to see that that's happening because not enough people are listening to them. So they're actually right. becoming they're coming closer to the business to make a difference.
I like that.
I struggle with that having, and I've been around long enough that I consider myself 50% a marketer and 50% an analyst. And I love going talking to the business and talking about and probing a little bit, like, what are you really trying to do? What's, you know, what are the outcomes we're trying to drive? I run into a lot of analysts who don't have that ability. I like the way that you're putting it. It's not just tell a better story. I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to if you're just about the data, then you probably aren't really equipped to do enough with the data. I'm going to sound kind of poppy, maybe, potentially. I mean, that's when I work with clients. And I'm often, you know, I'm in the room with a lot of non-analysts that I'm dealing with, and they seem to like me. And I reflect on why do they seem to like me? I'm like, oh, because we're actually having a discussion about their business. So that's the, hey, Tim's awesome. I am also at the same time saying, as an outside consultant, I don't have access to all your data. I have access to a subset of your data. What can I do to help you address that challenge? In a lot of cases, they don't have the analyst internally who should have access to any and all of the data, who can also have that discussion, who can also say, and you know what? Fine, sign me up. I will commit to helping you actually make this thing, make this change, make this a reality. I feel like I run into plenty of analysts in my clients who are just not, they really struggle to think about the business. Some of them even, they've fallen over their tools so much that That's all they want to do. Is let me just create another dashboard.
And it's a big space, right? You could spend, there are people who've spent their whole careers just invested in a specific tool and how it works. You know, and that is the summation of their expertise, and it's very deep and it's profound. But that means that you're part of a good team, but you can't be the team. And that's the distinction. And I think, you know, Kevin, you're not wrong that over the next 10 years, I think that's what we're all going to have to come to grips to, because there will come a point in time, and this already happens, and I bet all of us hear it from different places, where executives are like, I've spent quite a bit of money and I've got nothing in return. I get no value from these things that I was told to buy, quote unquote, or, you know, that everybody said, well, if you do this, that is a common refrain. Today and tomorrow, the money won't be there to invest in it. And we all owe it to ourselves as analysts to sort of start thinking about how do we kind of bridge that gap a little more. But I also want to throw out there that not every single person has to be what we are, but you should definitely recognize
that. You mean thought leaders, just to be clear?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what, no, I mean, in other words, to varying degrees, we kind of moved in sort of the business direction, you know, and kind of leveraged softer skills and things like that. I think there are people who are amazing. And Tim, I feel like you kind of embody this with sort of all the work you've done with R this year. People with really amazing quantitative skill sets and math and statistics and all those things, they don't have to become like, you know, can't think of a good example, but like some kind of cool person that none of us are, you know, and smooth and suave with the business people. It's more to understand what components make up what has to happen with analytics and knowing the personalities. And so as analytics leaders, one of the things that I think about a lot is what's the right team? How do you put the right team so that one person can handle those hard technical questions and somebody else is still minding the store when it comes to thinking strategically and interacting with the people?
And I think there's, you know, when you talk a little bit there about really what is the role of an analyst as married to a career path, okay? So I'll give you an example. I had an analyst at Nordstrom whose job it was to forecast sales by the hour every day. That's what he was supposed to do. And so by him doing that, he got to meet with the Nordstrom family. He got to meet with most of the senior executives on the retail and on the online side of the business. And he has, so he has this amazing job, but he was so content with that job that he didn't want to do anything else. In other words, he didn't really want to do anything statistical. You know, he already had what he wanted. And so I would never push that person to go into new projects or to try something different because that person was perfectly content. And I would have other analysts that were restless. And they wanted to be, you could tell that they eventually wanted to not be an analyst. They wanted to be working in the business. And so the projects that I would align them with were analytical projects that were purposely with a business person who would embrace what they were saying so that both sides would get something from it. And so I think there is this career path component to being an analyst that probably doesn't get talked about enough, but you get to pick where you want to go. And I wouldn't wait for somebody to pick that path for you. I would be very proactive about that. And in a pop analytics world, I think there is it's prescribed kind of where it is that you should head. And I think an analyst needs to take more ownership of what they want to do long term and have a vision for where they want to head.
So at the risk of opening a huge can of worms, what's your take on, I feel like there's a challenge, or I've made this point to several clients that say your only analyst is somebody who is content to check these boxes and punch these buttons and do these little simple trend lines in Excel. Those analysts are training every one of those stakeholders into what analytics is and how it works. So I think it's, if you've got a team and there's somebody who just wants to kind of, this is kind of their comfort level, this is what they want to do, I think that's okay. I think I struggle with anyone where you're representing the industry. And if you're letting yourself define it, if you're defining it by your little comfort zone, which means you're not trying to push yourself and learn and do more, then that would be okay if that was only kind of limiting your career and maybe you could just ride off into the sunset and do that for the rest of your career. What I have trouble grappling with is they're the stakeholders who are getting that. You've trained every one of them now that that's what analytics is, and a lot of them are going to leave and go on to another company, and it is like a virus that is going to spread. So I conceptually, I like the idea of saying, you know, pick your narrow path, get in your comfort zone, and you just want to be the stable analytics person. I feel like those people can really do harm to the industry because they're not pushing themselves and they're potentially training people in a bad way. Like they're overly limiting analytics. And then other analysts who are more motivated now have to overcome that barriers at the next company that those people stakeholders encountered. That's been on my mind of late as well.
So let's pretend you were managing a team and you've got three analysts and two of the analysts have that kind of mindset. Tell me how you would work with the rest of the people at your company to help them understand what the potential of analytics is versus the career path that two of your three analysts want to take. So to tell me how you would consider managing that process.
So I got into consulting partly so I wouldn't have to deal with that sort of situation. But I've always struggled with when I've had a team that was like almost 20 people in total. And then it was just like the two or three people who were in that mode of, I want to go heads down and I don't want to grow and learn. We could kind of manage around it. If it was a team where one person was gung-ho and driving and pushing and saying, how can we move the organization forward through what we're doing? And two people saying, everything that you introduce scares me because it means I'm going to have to think harder or do something different, or potentially my job will look different in 6 months or a year from today. I'd be having the conversation with them to say, is that the right role for you to be in? I had a lady who worked for me once at a large insurance company in the customer insights and analytics group. And about 2 months into her working for me, when we had a free to us college level class, Ohio State was going to be teaching a statistics class or more of a design of experiments class, and we were all required to take it, and she was resisting taking the class. And I was like, why are you resisting this? She's like, I'm not really a data person. I was like, you've been at the company for 15 years and you applied for a job inside the customer insights and analytics organization. What were you thinking? She's like, well, I mean, that's like the organization that has like a lot of buzz and a lot of cachet right now. So it seemed like it would be good for my career. And I'm just like, I can't help you. Like, I literally do not know how to communicate with somebody who is in the space and not passionate about it. So yeah, I guess the answer is I would leave, or I would probably be managing those two people out and trying to find people who are more motivated, is a very long-winded answer to that question. Do you have a better solution?
I don't know. I do not have a better solution. I think it's a challenge to align what analysts are good at, what their career paths are, and where you want what the business needs. And so that's just an art, and I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. I do know that over the next several years, analysts are going to have to come closer to the business and probably a little farther away from the tools and the vendors who provide those tools. I think that's going to be very important.
I agree also.
And upon that agreement, unfortunately, we are going to have to start to wrap up. But before we do, one of the things we do on the show is called The Last Call, where we kind of go around the horn, talk about something we're finding interesting, maybe a cool tool or vendor that we think. No, I'm just kidding. But anyways, Kevin, do you have a last call you want to share?
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Tim jumping in. I'm not Kevin, but as you noted, we started to have some audio quality issues there. So what I'm going to do is sort of paraphrase Kevin's last call. Basically, he started off by saying that he's speaking at a conference, and there's a link in the show notes, in Vermont, New Hampshire Marketing Group Conference, where he's actually built kind of a little business simulation tool in Excel, where all the attendees get to actually kind of run a mock business over a period of time with three products. He's got it built in with the cost of goods sold, and they get to kind of make the decisions about which channels they're investing in. And then this tool sort of simulates the outcomes. And he isn't necessarily pushing that conference, although it does look pretty interesting if you're in the New England area. It's a pretty low-cost conference. This is me editorializing. But he went on to say the reason that he was bringing that up is because he sees simulation as being one big thing that will be coming down the pipe for analysts. It's what's done with weather forecasting. If you're a Formula One racing team, they're building simulations, because simulations can really help you take a model or take a collection of models and actually really start to understand cause and effect when you start moving around different variables and really understanding your business. So it was really kind of a last call sort of pitching simulation. As a matter of fact, we chimed in and thought, wow, that would probably be a great topic for us to have in the future. So that's his last call. I apologize for the audio quality that you got to listen to me again rather than hearing Kevin himself. But that's kind of what he covered. And it was a great last call, even if the audio was very choppy. And now back to the actual episode with the actual audio.
Which is totally the wrong time. Way to bring up a brand new idea, Kevin, right at the end of the show.
Well, it's funny because I'm going to jump in with my last call. Because
yeah, go for it.
It is by no means the anti... I am fascinated by simulation. I feel like that may be something I get. My sense is that with simulation, it forces you to do some work to understand, to break down your business into some component bits and pieces. Like, you have to understand your business in order to build a model that you're going to use to do simulation and then run multiple simulations. As I loosely understand it, and literally 3 days ago, I sat with a statistics professor who was trying to explain how simulations worked. But my last call is an article, and this might be the first time we've had a semi-repeat on the last call front. Because, Michael, you have done a last call about the entire Analytics Made Skeezy blog, Mr. John Foreman.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan.
I'm going to last call a post from him from 4 years ago called Projecting Meth Demand Using Exponential Smoothing. What that is it basically explains how Holt Winter's forecasting works. And the reason I came to it was I was looking at some Adobe data, and I was in R, and I was looking at Adobe's anomaly detection and reading up on that. And I'd seen Holt Winter's before, and I had a legitimately wanted to understand kind of what's behind this forecasting. And the good old Measure Slack, Jules, I'm going to butcher his last name, Zuifbruggen. He's at ZJUUL on Twitter and in the Measure Slack. Said, hey, after I got some lengthy definitions of how Holt Winter's works, he pointed me to this projecting meth demand using exponential smoothing, which is, as John Foreman does, a witty scenario that then works through kind of step by step. Here's like a shitty way to forecast. Here's how you can make it a little bit better. Here's how you can make it a little bit better. Now stick with me and, oh, look, we're doing exponential smoothing and see how that works. We're decomposing the signal. We're putting this into place. So I recommend that specifically, especially if you're using Adobe. They're using it out the yin-yang for how they're doing their forecasting. And maybe it's a terrible way to do forecasting, but it seems like it's a hell of a lot better than fitting a trend line in Excel and stopping there.
Nice.
How's that?
No, that's really good. And I'm a huge John Foreman fan. Local Atlanta guy, MailChimp. Thank you very much.
That does make me think. I need to go back and finish reading his book. I've got it on my Kindle.
Yep.
What's your last call?
My last call is a long overdue last call. My colleague and coworker Leah Pika's Present Beyond Measure podcast. And she's been a guest on the show, but I think she's got some new episodes recently, especially the one she did recently with Gar Reynolds, which I think is really phenomenal. So check that out for a very specific take on how to visualize and tell stories with data better.
That's great. So I think you have another podcaster on. Andy took a little bit of a pot shot at data storytelling, and you recommended Aaliyah.
Hey.
Way to go. Kevin's never coming back now.
I'm not afraid.
This is not going to be the part one of 17 that we were hoping for.
Part one of 17, yeah. In our ongoing series. Well, if you've been listening to this show and you're thinking to yourself, man, what Kevin just said or what Tim just said, or even what I just said resonated, or you have questions about it, we would love to hear from you. Also, You heard Kevin give a homework assignment. I recommend everybody take that homework assignment and do some thinking on their own about it. It's a really good thing for us all to consider as analytics people. But as you're thinking about it, you've got comments, questions, please don't hesitate to hit us up both on our Facebook page, our site, analyticshour.io, and on the Measure Slack. We'd love to hear from you. You can also reach Kevin on his blog at blog.mindthatdata.com. And he's actually pretty accessible via the Twitter, at mindthatdata on Twitter. So, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. We're so glad we finally picked the lock on what it is that it can actually secure a guest of your stature. We think the show, after now these many years, 2 years in, we finally figured out. No, I'm just kidding. Anyways, thank you so much. It has been a delight to have you on the show.
Thank you both. And there are tens of thousands of analysts out there who don't have any connection to anything. They're working with executives and other coworkers who don't understand them. And you provide an opportunity for them to hear about some of the challenges that you have and how you deal with those things. Don't underestimate how important that is. There are just so many people that are lonely out there as analysts, and you provide a really good way for them to be able to hear different challenges and to do it in a lighthearted way and not a serious way, which I think is really good. So I appreciate what the two of you do, and I hope your listeners do as well.
Wow, thank you.
We made it through 54 episodes before we said, that's it, we're done, drop the mic, we're out. We just peaked, I think.
That's right, boom.
It's all downhill from here.
I like to say that we are the number one explicit analytics podcast on iTunes. All right. For the rest of you out there listening, thank you so much. And as always, for my co-host Tim Wilson and I, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Using your name with profanity, but in a very complimentary way.
That sounds good.
Have you ever thought of doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8 just to see if anybody like freaks out if you skip, just to mess with them?
I haven't thought of that.
Questions you've always wanted to ask Kevin. So if I remembered what my point was, son of a bitch. You know what, Michael? Why don't you just take it from there? We will see how much of this I am comfortable leaving publicly. Rock flag and pop analytics.